Welcome to this, the Thursday edition of Closer Look. I'm Jim Burris.
And I'm Rose Scott. Now, no matter which candidate emerges as the victor in a few weeks, our next president will have to deal with something that a lot of people have to deal with, and that is the national debt. We're going to talk about that in just a moment. But when you think about the national debt, everybody has debt, including business owners. They have debt, just like we have debt. The presidential debates, as we mentioned, are over. So what are business owners looking for now? What is their number one priority? Here on this program, we've talked to local people across all demographics to get their thoughts on this presidential election. And today, we continue those conversations with a look at the economy and how campaign promises or rhetoric has addressed issues related to jobs, taxes, and more. And we're going to talk specifically about businesses, small business owners. And we're joined by two right now. Here in studio with us is Janelle Darden. She's owner of the hair care company Moisture Love. And also Jocelyn Gregg, owner of Jardin Chocolates, a company we've actually profiled on this program. Welcome.
Thank you so much for having us.
Let me get your thoughts on this before we get all into the conversation. Do you worry, as business owners, do you have concerns about, wow, there's a new administration coming in, will consumer habits change, this could affect my business? Do you worry about that? Josh, I'll start with you.
There's always a little bit of nervousness, I think, anytime there's a major change for the whole country. I'm less worried about how customers will react because chocolate is a fairly nonpartisan thing, but more so that the environment and the economy will change and people might have more or less money to be spending on something that they don't actually need, like desserts.
Yeah.
I'd agree with Jocelyn. Being a hair care product, women would say it's not a discretionary thing, but some of our husbands might think differently. So I think the bigger concern for me as a business owner is how will the middle class feel when it comes to discretionary income and their ability to purchase what might be considered a luxury product.
When did you all start your businesses, Jocelyn?
We started October 1st of last year.
Janelle?
I initially launched the summer of 2011.
So you came after, obviously, the Great Recession was over. And so now you look at what's happening. Do you pay attention to what you've done in the past and try to change that to maybe even fit what you think might happen in terms of with the new administration coming in? Are you changing your business model at all to just try to get ahead of what you think might happen? I'm not trying to scare you by saying another recession is coming. But do you look at your business model and think, maybe we need to make some adjustments here?
I think I've been very kind of conservative about building up just because it is a very large unknown. So certain purchases that I might want to make to expand or grow the business, I might be holding off on a little bit.
So you're not ready to have a bigger chocolate candy manufacturing plant because you're waiting it?
I wouldn't necessarily be looking to upgrade my building, more so just getting new equipment, getting better equipment, upgrading some of the equipment that I have already.
You know?
I kind of look at it a little different. My perspective is trying to create the need for my product such that people will want to or figure out a way to purchase it regardless of what happens. So for us, it's always about keeping our awareness up, our social media presence, and helping to build value as a company such that the customer wants to make the purchase regardless.
And Jocelyn, I want to come back to you. When you look at expanding or whatever equipment you're holding off on buying, what is it about the presidential election or the candidate who wins that's making you take that pause?
There's just been a lot of unrest with both of them. I think someone was saying that this election has both these people have the highest unfavorability ratings, and I feel like that's just kind of set a very conservative mood on people's spending habits. And I'm noticing that a little bit. It could be that the seasons are changing. It could be the different holidays. But people's spending habits, I'm noticing, are fluctuating a lot.
So it's not that either candidate's going to implement a policy that could be detrimental to your business. It's actually consumer fear.
I think so, yeah.
Wow. And is this the first time? I know you're a relatively new business. Is this the first time that you've kind of had this consumer behavior reflected in something going on in the political realm?
It's absolutely the first time for us, just because I only have 1 year of knowledge and data to back up what I'm seeing. And also, there were a lot of other things that came into play in the last year in addition to this political environment.
Yeah, and for me, it's the first time, too, even though I've been in business for 5 years. This is typically going into what's considered our peak season, and we usually see the increase happening in September, but it's definitely slowed down significantly. And in speaking with some of my wholesalers, just to kind of get a pulse on what's going on with my brand and what's going on with them in general, all of them have said, and they're in different areas of the country, that this has been a very slow season for them as well.
And they equate that to
consumer fear, and concerns for what's going to happen in the next 2 weeks now, 3 weeks.
Yeah. What are some of the challenges you face as a small business owner right now, whether it relates to the presidential election or not?
I think it's always a matter of getting your product in front of more people. So for us, again, it's like Janelle said, getting in front of social media, staying on top of our advertising campaigns and our marketing campaigns, and my wholesalers, in addition, making sure that they have what they need. I think that's fairly across the board.
For me, I'd agree with Jocelyn in that. In addition to that would be access to capital and access to quality employees to help me grow the business, because there's always a concern as a small business, if I grow it, how will I maintain that growth? And needing that capital to bridge the gap, as well as the manpower to fulfill it.
That's interesting that you bring that up, Janelle, because that goes to the next question, because a big part of what we've been hearing is about raising the minimum wage. I don't know how many employees. How many employees do you have?
Right now, I only have a few part-time employees. I don't have any full-time, so about two or three.
Do you watch the conversations around the minimum wage, and what are your thoughts on that?
I
don't know if your employees are listening.
We have been, and I think, you know, from an employee perspective or from a labor perspective, there is a concern for wanting to be paid more. And for us, it's, you know, we want to be able to pay our employees more. We want to have the most worked for or most excited to work for a company. However, it goes back to that capital. How can we fund that? Where can we save something on a business perspective, or what kind of resources are out there for small businesses to do that?
And Jocelyn, when Closer Look visited your facility, you're a one-woman band right now doing a lot. But would you like to be able to hire some employees in the future?
I think eventually we'd like to expand. Obviously, every business wants to be huge and have a lot of employees, because that means you're successful, but that's not in the immediate goals right now. And I think a lot of the back and forth about both minimum wage and also paid family leave is something that's weighing very heavily on my mind, because, again, okay, you've got these employees, but now how do you pay them?
And I'm curious, do you believe any of the candidates, either candidate, is speaking to you as a small business owner? Do you believe that they have your interest at heart?
I mean, personally, I don't think either candidate has really mentioned what specifically they're going to do for small businesses. Both have talked about tax breaks and corporate tax breaks and, you know, working families and middle-income families. But no one's really specifically saying, like, this is what I want to do to help small businesses.
I completely agree with that point. I was thinking about that yesterday. I think one mentioned it so briefly, it was kind of off in the whim. But I don't think that anyone has any policies directed to it specifically.
And do you believe that there is something that a candidate could say that would resonate with you? What would it be?
Well, since we know that small businesses employ a large percentage of the United States, it would be great if a candidate came up with a program that provided grants for small businesses to employ more people or to offer better wages. Or if there were tax breaks specifically designed for small businesses versus all these tax breaks for large corporations.
Jocelyn, what would you like to see?
Also, in addition to that, something specific to helping local communities. We try and employ other local small businesses to be our suppliers and our ingredient sourcing. If there was some sort of thank you for that, like a reward for we are helping our local community and not just Georgia State or the corporate government, the federal government as a whole, something specifically for our community.
One of the candidates, and we know that was Donald Trump, talked about being able to not pay taxes. I mean, you know, and that's not just Donald Trump. There are a lot of folks out there. But when you hear something like that, just even whether it was from Donald Trump or Hillary Clinton, when you hear something like that and you're a small business owner and you all pay taxes, but what goes through your mind? I mean,
I understand the legality behind it. I understand how depreciation works. It still is just really, it feels very unfair, though.
Completely agreed. I mean, it just doesn't feel right. How can a billionaire pay zero and I make significantly less than that and I paid significantly more than zero? So it's just kind of a tough pill to swallow.
Well, gender has played a big role during this election season, and especially over the last few weeks. And on this program, we know we've talked about the gender pay gap and what some local groups are doing to address it. You're both women and you own your own businesses. What kind of conversations are you hearing, or are you, maybe you've heard during this election year, that in terms of gender pay gap and how it encourages you or concerns you?
Well, I mean, for me, I think it's nice that the conversation is becoming so prevalent. Over the past few years, it hadn't been spoken of as much as it could have. So, but it's also discouraging to know that it is still that significant and that rampant. So really want to see what will honestly happen to make up that difference.
And just having more conversation about women in the workplace, whether it's as part of the paid family leave conversation or as part of the wage gap, talking about women in the workplace is important because there's still a stigma about women not being entrepreneurs, which is obviously not the case.
Right.
Well, here's a question. Why did you start your business, Jocelyn?
I looked around and I noticed that no one in Atlanta was fulfilling that I, as a restaurant person, as a pastry chef, needed. No one was making what I needed, so I saw a niche and I wanted to fill it.
And you're making?
And I am making individual shell-molded, hand-painted chocolates.
All right. Janelle, why'd you start your business?
I went natural in 2005. I couldn't find products that worked for me.
Now you have to back up because some folks, what do you mean by going natural?
I had a chemical relaxer that was relaxing the natural curls that my hair has. And so I stopped chemically relaxing my curls and wearing them the way that they grow out of my hair. And I couldn't find products that were designed for me with the proper moisture and balance. And so someone introduced me to shea butter. I started making it and the rest was history.
Shea butter.
Yes.
It all started with shea butter.
It all started with shea butter.
And when was this?
2005.
Okay.
2005. And I actually bought my first lot of shea butter in the West End of Atlanta.
Well, we've talked about maybe the challenges that you all face in this presidential cycle and kind of some apprehensiveness on your part about who wins. Are there any things that you're optimistic about that you see going right as we go into this presidential election as it concerns small business?
I don't know if it's necessarily specifically concerning small business, but I have seen a lot of more people actually talking about politics. I think a lot of people kind of view politics as only for a certain segment of society, but now everyone's kind of involved in the conversation because something that either one of these candidates said at some point has driven someone to want to have their opinions heard.
Yeah, and I think for myself as an African-American woman, I'm very proud of what I'm hearing in my community around wanting to actually vote this time around and be involved in the decisions that are going to be made with this election. So that's very encouraging for me.
Last question as we end here, I want to ask you if you had to say something or if you could say something directly to either candidate or both candidates in terms of being a small business owner, what would you say?
I would say they always like to talk about what they're going to do in the first 100 days. I'd like to see a policy that directly helps small businesses earn more money or keep more money inside of their company in the first 100 days.
I think that they should actually come out and see small businesses. They go around and they talk to a lot of everyday people kind of on the street, but come in and see what we're doing every day and see our everyday challenges and spend a week with us and just really understand the challenges that small businesses face because they're different from the challenges that large corporations face.
And where do you see your businesses a year from now, Jocelyn?
Hopefully still growing and still making people happy, maybe with a couple employees.
In a year, I'm focusing on having more mass distribution. We find that our products are currently sold online at moisturelove.com, but more of our customers want to be able to purchase it on the ground. So hopefully in a year, we'll have at least double what we have now in wholesale.
Now, here on Closer Look, we bring people together. So here's my idea. So when you buy the hair care product, maybe you get a coupon for a discount at the Jardine chocolate.
I like it. Right. I like
okay,
it.
What do you think? Yeah, or you buy some chocolates, you get a coupon for some
absolutely.
Discount. Jim, I don't know what to tell you.
Looks like I'm out of luck on this one, right?
Get a coupon at JardineChocolates.com for Moisture Lock for someone in your family.
Right.
I would look good with some Moisture Locks, right?
Okay,
yes,
absolutely.
Moisture Love, yes.
Sorry, Moisture Love.
Well, now on that note, we've been talking about small business owners, getting their perspectives on issues related to business and the economy during this election season. Our guests have been Janelle Darden, owner of the hair care company Moisture Love, and Jocelyn Gregg, owner of Jardine Chocolates. Thank you both for coming in and taking the time.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And Closer Look continues here on 90.1 WABE, Atlanta's choice for NPR. Alongside Jim Burris, I'm Rose Scott. No matter which candidate emerges as the victor in a few weeks, our next president will have to deal with something that is very familiar with. That's the national debt. During last night's presidential debate, Hillary Clinton made this promise.
I also will not add a penny to the debt.
Donald Trump said he'd address the debt by increasing the nation's gross domestic product. Here's how he said he'd do that.
I'm going to create tremendous jobs.
All right. Well, here's some context. In case you're wondering, the last time our national debt was paid off, January 8th, 1835. Guess how much it was, Rose?
$6 million.
$6 million.
I'm just 1835.
Yeah, we weren't around then. $37,000.
Really?
And so I went to the inflation calculator. It'd be about $1 billion in today's money. But a billion compared to almost $20 trillion.
Wow.
Well, it turns out our debt-free status lasted 1 year. And since then, we've been on an overspending roller coaster. The current tally, more than $19.7 trillion.
With a T.
With a T, not a B. Trillion. Broken down, that means each person's share is about what the average house would cost here in Metro Atlanta. Well, recently I sat down with Dr. Alan Axelrod, the New York Times best-selling author and Atlanta resident, just released his latest book, It's Full Faith and Credit, The National Debt, Taxes, Spending, and the Bankrupting of America. And I ask, just when did the debt get this bad?
So where this really started in recent history, I would say, is with the administration of Lyndon Johnson. Now, Lyndon Johnson, at the end of his administration, the national debt had only risen about 4%. I mean, it's a considerable amount, but by today's standards, where you had under Barack Obama, the national debt rise about 71%, under Ronald Reagan, the president who came in to make government small and to cut spending, it rose 105%. So by that standard, it doesn't seem very alarming. But what Johnson did, of course, is proposed, in fact executed, this very ambitious, very noble program called the Great Society, which built on the New Deal of Franklin Roosevelt, and which includes things that people do not want to let go of, such as Medicare and Medicaid. And that was expensive in itself, but then, of course, the Vietnam War blew up from what, you know, back in that day was called a brush fire war, blew up into a very major, very costly war. Johnson was left with a question. Can you possibly finance both this extraordinarily ambitious social program and what has become a very major war? His answer was, yes, we are a great society. We can do it. And in fact, we could do it, provided that we borrowed most of the money to do it. And that's where that attitude began, that borrowing at a very, on a very large scale became an acceptable way of running the government as a matter of routine business. And what followed Johnson was President Nixon, of course, and President Nixon found himself in an embarrassing situation. We were on the gold standard back then. We did not have sufficient gold reserves to back our currency. His solution was to take the nation off the gold standard. As soon as we did that, everybody started pulling out, and since then, all of the currencies have sort of freely floated against one another. But that also gave President Nixon the option of, or at least the Federal Reserve during his administration, of printing more money, increasing the money supply by simply printing more currency. And I'm old enough to remember what happened. What happened is that you got something called stagflation, which was this wonderful economic phenomenon that gave us the perils of both inflation and a stagnant economy, an economy that didn't grow. And this was the worst of both worlds. We didn't learn our lesson. We've kept doing this, and we've kept manipulating the economy with the Federal Reserve and so on. To the average person, you still have a job, things seem to be going okay, not too bad. But in the meantime, the national debt rises and it begins to drain the economy.
And that leads me to my next question, and that is, what does a number like approaching $20 trillion mean in tangible terms to me? I mean, how do I see this in my everyday life?
Let's say you are a baby born today. You come into the world with over $60,000 in debt. Now, you know that you haven't spent it in utero, but you have this debt. It's not literal in the sense that somebody can come to your door and demand it, but it has the effect of carrying that kind of debt in the way it reduces your spending power, it reduces your savings, your disposable income that you could save. It really begins to cramp your life. If you are a taxpayer, by the way, just to get the figure correct, you are saddled with $164,000 in debt. And it's as if you went to sleep one night and woke up in the morning and discovered that your identity had been stolen and somebody had taken out a couple of mortgages in your name. It's a very frightening prospect. Most of us don't realize that because we just see this big number and we figure it's the government. It's the government that pays it. Well, we are the government. This is our debt and it's our money. And worst of all, it is the legacy that we are going to be bequeathing to our children if this is allowed to go on unchecked. Even more a cramped economy where money that the government could be spending on useful things, things that would stimulate the economy, that would enable the economy, things like infrastructure, systems that, for example, might have prevented a train from running through the wall of a station a couple of weeks ago. Instead of doing that, they are having to service this debt to maintain the full faith and credit of the United States and keep from going bankrupt.
What can we do at this point? And I have to think of it in terms of my own debt-to-income ratio, which my, you know, credit score reflects mm-hmm. every time I look at it. If I had a debt-to-income ratio of 105%, I would be in some real trouble.
Yes.
And so if I am that consumer and I have that outrageous kind of scenario, how do I pay it down?
And of course, the reason that we can't do such a thing is that nobody thinks much of us. We are thought of in terms of our ability to repay a loan. The United States is thought of as a very stable, very great nation that no matter what happens will pay its debts. And I would say the one warning sign that we should be picking up on is that China, which is our single biggest foreign debt holder, in 2015 pretty much stopped buying treasuries. And you have to wonder what this portends. The national debt can be addressed quite simply in financial terms. You have to do two things. You have to cut spending, reduce spending, and you have to find ways to increase revenue into the government. Very straightforward. Politically, it's very difficult to address this issue because this debt has accumulated through what economists would call suboptimal decisions. That is, we have an elected government that depends on each individual elected official would like to keep his or her job, and his or her job depends not directly on doing what is best for the nation as a whole. And when you make decisions about a huge institution, such as the United States, but do it on the basis of a relatively limited number of people or special interests who are helping to finance your reelection, you are making suboptimal decisions. You are making decisions that benefit this group, but often at the expense of the nation. So that is the political end of things. You, as a politician, you want to keep your job, you want to get a better job, get elected to a higher office, you therefore want to please your constituents, and what happens is that you make decisions to benefit them, and you neglect the country as a whole.
This is where we get bridges to nowhere,
correct,
commonly referred to, or pork projects.
Correct. Pork barrel spending is part of this, and the huge military budget, for example, much of which is wasteful, much of which is unnecessary, and that comes from the fact that this country, prior to World War II, never had an arms industry. It had places that made guns and things like that, But when there was a war, ordinary manufacturers converted to making weapons. And when the war was over, they went back to making consumer goods. Well, World War II was such an industry-intensive war that it became clear that you needed dedicated arms manufacturers. And the government supported that. The government underwrote that. When the war was over, they didn't want to disassemble all of this, throw all these people out of work. So you had to find ways to keep the armament industry going. And of course, this is what President Eisenhower famously called in his farewell address in 1961, the military-industrial complex. In his original version of the speech, he wanted to call it the military-industrial congressional complex, but he didn't want to offend Congress, so he crossed that out. And this is where we are stuck now. We have financial needs that are directly opposed to political motives. This is also true, by the way, of the unelected government, the bureaucracy. The bureaucracy has a vested interest in growing government because you want a career.
So job security.
Not only job security, but a place to go, a place to rise to. If you're working for a little company, maybe you've got one or two jobs you can take and that's it. You've exhausted the hierarchy. If you're working for a huge government, you can rise up through that whole maze of civil service designations, make more money, have more security, and have a more challenging job. So careerism, both on the elected and unelected government, really militates against making the decisions to decrease spending.
I want to touch on this, and we only have a few minutes left, unfortunately. You also address wasteful spending and regulation. And I want to use an example that you cite in your book. It's about turkey ham.
Yes.
It is a federal crime to sell turkey ham as ham turkey, or to print the words turkey and ham in different fonts. I think most of us would agree this is somewhat absurd.
Yes.
How does it translate, though, to waste?
Well, it requires, first of all, that's representative of a certain class of regulation. And these are regulations that are either invented for no conceivable reason, or they are invented at the behest of some special interest. There is a cost in ensuring compliance with regulations. Now, on one side of the political spectrum, there are people who would like an end to all regulation. Well, that would be counterproductive because we'd all be dying of food poisoning and we'd have cell phones that suddenly burst into flame. So we don't want to do this, but we could do with an audit of regulations. In the something like 2.2 million non-postal employees and non-uniformed military employees that are in the government, that are full-time employees, there are 300,000 lawyers dedicated to creating regulations, to actually crafting new regulations. And this does seem rather excessive. So you need to weigh the benefits and the costs of regulation. And on the other hand, it's very hard to put a price tag on a lot of the benefits of regulation. How much is a human life worth, for example? So it's not an easy thing. As far as the waste goes, this would be one way to really begin to approach the problem of cutting expenditures. We need to engage in a very serious government-wide audit and start finding areas of waste and fraud and simply unauthorized spending, which goes on. Nobody authorized it, but it's being spent. We need to identify these things and stop doing them. And that is a good dent in the growth of the national debt.
It seems so obvious, and you've touched on why that potential energy is not kinetic. But what really is the barrier? If you can lay it all out in black and white and say, this is what's going to happen if we don't do this, the plan is right there. How come this falls on deaf ears and the things that have always happened just continue to happen?
Well, the politicians are never going to do it on their own because politicians are in the business of giving people things. They aren't in the business of asking for sacrifice. You know, even when we had the Iraq War begin, the war was sold to the American people as something that, well, you wouldn't really have to sacrifice. We've got an all-volunteer army. They'll do it. And you should go shopping. I mean, this was actually suggested. So politicians will go to great lengths not to ask for sacrifice. So it has to be the voters who demand sacrifice. And this is a very, very hard thing to do. The consequences of not doing it are likely eventual default on the national debt. It will reach a point that all our creditors will finally say, well, we can't invest in this anymore. And it won't be a pretty thing as we approach that point. This is something that has to be addressed sooner rather than later. It's certainly limiting, if not our own future, depending how old each of us is, that of our children and our grandchildren.
Our guest has been New York Times bestselling author and historian Alan Axelrod. His latest book is Full Faith and Credit, The National Debt, Taxes, Spending, and the Bankrupting of America. It's on bookstore shelves right now. Dr. Axelrod, thank you so much for coming on the program.
It's been a great pleasure. Thank you for having me.
You know, Jim, in Georgia, food insecurity is a problem, a big problem. According to the organization Feeding America, nearly 1.8 million in Georgia live in an area labeled as food insecure. Now, a major solution is improving access to healthy and, most importantly, affordable food. That means neighborhood grocery stores or markets. On a previous edition of Closer Look, we talked about the Carver Neighborhood Market located in Southeast Atlanta. And producer Candace Wheeler and I paid a visit. We found out that this market, well, it's much more than a grocery store. Joel Barber won't admit it, but he's quite the barista.
Worked here for about 4 years almost. Started when I was in high school because I knew everybody over here. And then once I grew up in it, I got a job once I was old enough. And then it's easier to have a job here right now at the place I am now because they're still in college and all that stuff. So
Joel remembers when this neighborhood did not have any options for buying groceries.
Like they say, I mean, this whole area, Lakewood, South Atlanta, was a food desert, man, as they keep saying. If you want to get food, you got to go 10 miles out to Kroger, to Publix, wherever. And that's if you got transportation. If you don't got transportation, you got to hop on the bus. And then once let's say you need a lot of groceries, that means coming all the way back with a whole bunch of groceries and all this. So it's always a hassle. So having a grocery store here is really, really helpful for the neighbors in the local area, as well as the coffee shop is here too. So.
When he's not serving up lattes and espressos, Joel is studying film and TV production at Georgia State. Yes, inside the market is a community coffee shop. Frankie is also a barista. We chatted as she prepared a customer's coffee.
Will that be all for you?
Mm-hmm. Okay. What is it about this place and what it means to the community?
It just really feels homey. It's right here in the middle of this neighborhood that they say is a bad neighborhood. But when you come here, it doesn't really feel like it. And to be honest, the neighborhood is really on the upside. It's growing. We're getting busier here. More people are coming out. And it just makes you feel really happy that you're doing a positive thing in the community, especially with this market being here. So it's a really great job.
The Carver Neighborhood Market is located at the intersection of Jonesboro and McDonough Boulevard. Just down the block is the new schools at Carver High School. And a few yards away on the opposite side of the street is a recycling plant. So, what's the backstory of this neighborhood? After Reconstruction, many blacks settled in this part of town. Segregation meant businesses were created, operated, and supported by blacks within their own communities.
When the building was built, the back part was the Carver Theater, where we got our name from.
Jeff Delp is the director of economic development for the market.
So people came in there and watched movies before 1950s or 60s, whenever it closed. And the front part was a commercial area. So this really was the center of a neighborhood when it was a healthy, thriving neighborhood.
But like a lot of neighborhoods, then a familiar pattern occurred. Middle-class black families moved away. Businesses closed. A nearby General Motors plant, Lakewood Assembly, shut its doors in 1990.
Hi, my name is Jim Alexander. I've been in this neighborhood for 40 years.
Really?
Yeah.
You've seen a lot come and go, huh?
I've seen a whole lot come and go.
How important is this market to the neighborhood?
It's very important. As a matter of fact, I was one of the first members to join when they set it up. Yeah, I look forward to it.
You feel like you can get everything that you need here at this market?
Everything I need, yeah, yeah. Matter, unfortunately, my wife passed not a little too long ago, so I'm bacheloring it, so my needs are real small. They got frozen dinners. But seriously, you know, they carry a really good line of vegetables. I'm a vegetable guy, and so.
The Carver Neighborhood Market and Coffee Shop are owned by Focus Community Strategies. The organization partners with underserved neighborhoods. Jim Wehner is the president.
Yeah, we're probably better known as FCS. For years, we just used our initials, but we are a neighborhood-based community development group. We have three or four different programs that we focus on. We're really focused in housing, providing affordable housing and some market-rate mixed-income housing in the neighborhood. We do economic development, which is the coffee shop and the Carver Market and the bike shop.
How would you assess how Carver has been able to do here?
I would say we're just tremendously both surprised at what it's been able to accomplish, and we're really enjoying the process of being able to add this to the community. We've been surprised at how it's helped holistically, sort of because it's connected to the coffee shop, and it's really serving very different groups in the neighborhood. It seems to be hitting a holistic need, and we're excited about that. We feel like there is a lot of push for healthy foods in the food industry, and not always a push for affordable. So we love that we can add affordable and healthy to the neighborhood and try to figure out how to do that mix well. We feel like the neighborhood has been very gracious to receive us as we've figured out, as a nonprofit organization, how to be grocers, right? So
now what's the next step? What areas do you feel still need improvement? And do you look at it from a five-year plan, or you just take it year by year? What's the next step here?
Yeah, that's a really good question. We we started with a three-year plan or pro forma budget to try to get it to what we would call cash flow. So we're not looking for a profit out of it, but we want it to fund its training programs and staff development programs that we have because we have a number of folks from the neighborhood employed here. So I think we would like to be able to get it to that point. We're trying to figure out the right product selection. We've got very limited space. What we're sort of calling the right-sized retail for the neighborhood, but trying to figure out what are the right products to have on limited shelf space.
There's frozen meat, fresh fruit, and the basic food staples. This 2,000-square-foot grocery store isn't very big compared to the bigger grocery store chains, but Carver Market is much more than a neighborhood grocery store option, says manager Jatel Woods.
It's too important to the neighborhood. I mean, just as far as us being in the food desert and us providing fresh fruits and vegetables to the community, but also we do so many other things for the community. A lot of people use our space to have different events that they probably wouldn't be able to have without purchasing space. We're also just here to kind of be mentors, if you will, to some of the youth that have developed through here. Joel, I don't know if you spoke to him, but he's worked for this guy for all of his adolescence. So, we're just here. We're here to help. So we're very important. We have to be here.
You interact a lot with the customers. What do they say about this market?
They say they like it. They want Walmart prices. This isn't Walmart. But so far, that's the only negative feedback I got. People love it. They want us to sell alcohol and beer. We will never do that, probably. So that at least in the near future. So those are just some of the feedback we got.
You see this market being the cornerstone for economic development in this area?
Absolutely. I mean, it adds unspeakable value. You take this market out, what else is around here? 11.6 miles, there's nothing, right? I mean, in terms of a liquor store, yes, you know, you see that in communities like this all the time. But in terms of viable businesses, no, no one's here. So hopefully this is the jumping off platform, if you will. This business is the model for a viable business that can survive without taking advantage of the community and people that can't get in a car and drive and things like that.
And what about you personally? What does this mean for you in terms of your position?
It means a lot to me. I'm here because I feel like this job provides a lot of purpose. I live a block away, so I'm also here as a customer before I was here as a manager. And for me, I just try to contribute in a positive way every day. This is the way I give back to the community. So,
and a community that you grew up in.
Absolutely. A community where I have very strong roots. So, you know,